This is ground zero on the capital budget.
Governor Walker's administration releases a slimmed-down capital budget. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, December 15th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator-elect Dan Sullivan gets four committee assignments for the upcoming Congress.
Well, look, I'm pleased with all of them. These were actually the four committees that I requested.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Fish Basket Coalition, working to secure a bright future for Bristol Bay and the Bering Sea, where fishing means business. Visit fishbasket.org to learn more.
And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
By law, Alaska's governor is required to submit a budget by December 15th. Having been in office for only 2 weeks, Governor Bill Walker elected to submit his predecessor's operating budget today without endorsement. But he did make some changes to former Governor Sean Parnell's capital budget. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
The capital budget Governor Sean Parnell was working on was already slim. At $200 million in state spending, it was a fraction of some of the capital budgets passed when oil prices were high. Now, that amount has been cut in half.
This is ground zero on the capital budget.
That's Pat Pitney, the new budget director. Outside of funding for a couple of water treatment plants and a sewer project, the capital budget submitted on Monday is mostly made up of projects that come with federal grant money.
I mean, this is an unendorsed budget. We haven't had time to evaluate all the projects. We did know we want to keep the transportation funds and those projects that rely heavily on match funding.
According to the new capital budget, the state will seek about $1 billion in federal grants, mostly for airport and road improvements. Not everything with federal matching grants survived the new budget, though. $500,000 for maintenance on shooting ranges was slashed, even though it was mostly federally funded. Walker's budget also doesn't include funding for mega projects like a 200-mile road to the Ambler Mining District or the Susitna-Watonna Dam, mega projects that have received considerable funding in the past. A line for the Kinnickarm Bridge crossing was also zeroed out, even though Parnell's budget only included federal funding for the proposed $1 billion bridge. Pitney says that's because in the long run, it's
a major, major state commitment. And it's one of the large projects the transition team asked to take a harder look at.
Pitney says the Walker administration will be reviewing that project and others between now and the legislative session to see if they should be put back in. They have until February 18th to make changes to their budget. But Pitney's not expecting a lot of projects to get added. She says that any extra items should fall into the category of investment projects, like money for a gas line.
Are there things now that if you invest in can either return revenue or reduce costs in the future?
Pitney says there isn't a hard cap for legislators to keep in mind when it comes to infrastructure spending. Representative Steve Thompson is the co-chair of the House Finance Committee, and he's tasked with preparing the capital budget. The Fairbanks Republican says there isn't a target number yet, but he expects spending to be substantially reduced from previous years, with critical projects for health and safety getting the most consideration.
You know, I don't think that people are going to be wanting to flex their muscles too much with the financial situation the state is in.
Thompson adds he wasn't surprised to see the capital budget strip mostly to projects with matching funds.
I didn't think there was going to be anything other than possibly federal grant match money. And I've been warning people that that's what it's starting to look like prior to this coming out.
With North Slope crude now below $60 per barrel, lawmakers may have to draw nearly $7 billion in savings to pay for the budget that passed this year, along with the new one they will be drafting. If no changes are made to the $5 billion operating and capital plan submitted Monday, the Department of Revenue expects the state to run a $3 billion deficit. In Washington, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The Republicans in the U.S. Senate today announced their committee assignments for the next 2 years. Alaska's Dan Sullivan will come in with the lowest seniority of the 100 senators, primarily because he's never held elected office before. But as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, it doesn't seem to have hurt him on the committee score.
Sullivan will serve on Armed Services, Veterans Affairs, Commerce, and Environment and Public Works. And he says he can hardly pick a favorite.
Well, look, I'm pleased with all of them. These were actually the four committees that I requested.
It's through committees that senators can shape legislation, and their assignments define their spheres of influence. The Commerce Committee is of particular interest to Alaska because it oversees fisheries, as well as the Coast Guard and civil aviation. Alaska's Ted Stevens chaired that panel near the end of his career. Sullivan says Environment and Public Works doesn't get as much attention.
But over the course of the last several months, I said that that was a committee I'd be very interested in just because of the oversight role it has with regard to certain federal agencies, particularly the EPA.
Sullivan, like other Republicans, made fighting the EPA a pillar of his campaign. It should be an interesting time for the Environment Committee. Its incoming chairman, Oklahoma Republican Jim Inhofe, believes man-made global warming is a hoax. The committee is also responsible for writing the multi-year transportation bill. Senator Lisa Murkowski becomes chairman of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee in the new Congress. She'll also keep her other three assignments, which are Appropriations, Indian Affairs, and Health and Education. Murkowski says Sullivan's committee list is a good counterpart to hers.
Between what he has been assigned and what I have retained, I think we have covered everything across the state. I think it's a great, great pairing.
Sullivan will be sworn in January 6. Until then, Mark Begich remains in office, and he's in the Capitol longer than expected while the Senate tries to wrap up for the year. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
While election season may have just ended, there's already a push to gather signatures for a new ballot measure in 2016. A small group of supporters behind an effort to criminalize what they see as corruption in Alaska politics gathered at the Division of Elections on Friday for a training on how to collect the roughly 30,000 signatures they'll need from across the state. Ray Metcalf is directing the push to bring the issue to voters.
This initiative will make it a crime for legislators to vote, to appropriate money, or deliver economic benefits to themselves, their employers, their families. When they're conflicted, they need to recuse themselves from voting.
Without measures making it officially illegal to wheel and deal, Metcalf says actions that are clear offenses in other states are par for the course here, citing the recent Senate Bill 21 oil tax vote in the legislature.
You had two employees of ConocoPhillips voting to give their employer a $1 billion tax break, and that would not be permissible under this law.
Metcalf says the initiative has broad party support from the Democrats, Libertarians, Greens, and even some Tea Party members. The Republican Party has not endorsed the measure. Supporters have a year to gather all the signatures needed. Once submitted, a comprehensive certification process begins within the Division of Elections as they check line by line, signature by signature, that enough Alaskans support the idea to send it to the Lieutenant Governor for approval. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the first signs that climate change is affecting the health of Alaskans.
If we lose our water and sewer system, it's going to be a major blow to our village.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
University of Alaska President Pat Gamble will step down at the end of the school year. Vice President of University Relations Carla Beam says Gamble announced his plan to retire on June 1, 2015 to UA Regents during an executive session on Friday.
I think he was, you know, as we all do when we get older, was considering, you know, when the right time was to retire. He's had almost a 50-year career of public service.
Gamble has served in the Air Force, headed the Alaska Railroad, and the University of Alaska, where he's been president since 2010. Beam says UA Regents were surprised and saddened by the news. Regents attempted to retain Gamble through the 2016 school year with a $320,000 salary bonus this summer. In September, Gamble asked Regents to rescind the bonus, and the board complied. Beam says Regents plan to meet in January to discuss finding a successor to Gamble. The Fairbanks area continues to struggle with fine particulate pollution from wood smoke and other sources. Wintertime air inversions trap emissions at ground level, dropping air quality below federal Clean Air Act standards. Much of the North Star Borough is classified a federal non-attainment area by the Environmental Protection Agency based on air quality monitoring in Fairbanks. But as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the EPA plans to begin using monitoring data from North Pole, where pollution is typically much worse.
The Environmental Protection Agency uses a three-year average of monitoring data to come up with a number representative of local fine particulate pollution. The so-called design value is calculated from pollution readings from a long-running downtown Fairbanks air monitoring device. A similar monitor was set up in North Pole in 2012, and EPA planner Lucy Edmondson says it's accumulated 3 years of winter pollution samples.
So beginning in 2015, data from this site will be used for calculating the design value for the non-attainment area.
That's significant because North Pole's air is generally a lot worse than Fairbanks. A group of local activists, including former Fairbanks resident Sylvia Schultz, have been pushing for consideration of North Pole data, which Schultz says shows significantly higher pollution levels.
Daily average numbers are approximately three times higher than downtown Fairbanks, and the annual could be twice as high as downtown Fairbanks.
Schultz hopes official recognition of North Pole monitoring data leverages action to clean up the air. North Star Borough Air Quality Manager Ron Lovell is not convinced that the North Pole monitor is an accurate measure of local conditions.
We have to prove that it is neighborhood scale, meaning that it's not being overly influenced by a emission source that's placed in extremely close proximity, which is giving it artificial high values.
Lovell says additional monitoring sites have been established in North Pole to better assess the situation, but inclusion of North Pole data will likely take the borough even further from federal standards.
Make it a harder challenge to get to attainment.
Failure to reach Clean Air Act standards can affect federal funding and put stricter limits on emission sources. Fine particulates are a proven health hazard, and Department of Environmental Conservation Air Quality Division Director Alice Edwards maintains the agency already has an area-wide focus.
We always have had to demonstrate attainment in all parts of the non-attainment area, and of course the borough, through their programs, have been trying to target into some of these hotspot areas like North Pole.
The borough programs include subsidized wood boiler and wood stove changeouts, which are among measures included in the state air quality improvement plan scheduled for submittal to the EPA by the end of the month. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
After a bumpy start, Bethel Winter House has opened its doors once again with new rules. That's after a newly hired volunteer coordinator quit and organizers shut the homeless shelter down for three nights. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has more.
The all-volunteer shelter's board, organized under a Lions Club, met Thursday to sort out problems that closed the shelter last week. Organizers said clients were breaking rules and sneaking in alcohol. One volunteer claimed police didn't show up or showed up too late when called. Bethel's police chief Andre Ashe attended the meeting and said his department was short-staffed but did respond to calls for service. A handful of shelter guests also attended the meeting. They said there were indeed problems with people sneaking in alcohol and also with guests mixing hand sanitizer and other products containing alcohol into water bottles. The shelter reopened Friday with the new procedure of checking guests' backpacks and coats at the front door. They also searched them for alcohol and other prohibited intoxicants. Eva Malvich is the Bethel Winter House Lions Club president.
We monitor who we take in, and if the people that come in don't want to comply with the rules, then we'll ask them to leave.
One woman left the shelter rather than go through the new check-in procedure Friday night. Another shelter guest said he was grateful for the new rules. He added that he spent the nights the shelter was closed roaming the streets seeking warmth at the hospital emergency room when it got too cold. Temperatures dipped into the single digits last week, and snow fell overnight Friday. Volunteers formed Bethel's only homeless shelter after a flurry of deaths by exposure in 2012. In 2013, they provided a safe place for more than 80 regular guests to be out of the elements, and there was only one death that year. The winter shelter opened December 1st and has been serving 15 to 20 guests nightly. Organizers say they hope the new rules curb problems and that safety is their top priority. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The Aquila House in Anchorage turned 40 this year. It's one of Anchorage's oldest substance use treatment facilities. Now it has programs in communities and prisons across the state. Ron Green graduated from the Aquila House Residential Treatment Facility in the late 80s. He says the program used to rely on extreme measures to break down people's defenses.
It was crazy in those days. Sleep deprivation, they kept us up for days on days in. We did just some crazy things that are probably, I know they're not allowed to do nowadays. It would probably be considered client abuse, but in those days, they did it.
Green says it worked. He's been sober for 27 years now. He was also helped by the continued support of the program. He could only move out if he had another sober person to live with him. Other graduates say Aquila taught them basic living skills, like cleaning and answering the phone. Aquila CEO Rosalie Nado says their methods have changed dramatically since the early days, but they still use the ideas of a therapeutic community.
We do it more in group, where they get confronted on their behavior. You know, what do you mean you're good? I saw you doing this, and you talk all kinds of crap, and we can't have that. So we do that kind of thing now, but we do more of it. It's less confrontive, it's less personally demeaning.
Nado says they adapt their methods for different groups. Confrontation isn't as effective for people with other mental health disorders or for women with children. Julia Louie graduated from Aquila House in 2008 when she was 21 and now manages one of Aquila's other programs. She says growing through the recovery program was brutal, but forced her to grow up. She says her most significant relationships were with the other clients who helped run the house. They taught her an important message.
That there's hope, that there's a different way to live. And you don't think that there is when you are addicted, and that that's going to be your life for the rest of your life. And it's a lot of hard work, but if you're honest and you are motivated to change, it's there and it's everywhere.
Aquila House started as one facility in 1974. 8 years ago, they began expanding and have now grown from 11 employees to 180 and run programs from Ketchikan to Nome.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Alaska Pacific University is proud to announce the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. Deadline to apply is March 1, 2015. Alaska Pacific University, a private nonprofit committed to personalized experiential learning that incorporates Alaska as its principal classroom. More at 1-800-252-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
Memorial services were held over the weekend for Eric Peterson, the Delta Junction man killed in an avalanche in the Alaska Range. An avalanche expert who surveyed the area of the eastern Alaska Range where the deadly slide came down says the snowpack on mountainsides near Rainbow Ridge remains unstable. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, that's delayed efforts to recover Peterson's body.
Sarah Carter with the Alaska Avalanche Information Center says a 600 by 150 foot expanse of snow engulfed skiers Eric Peterson and Mike Hopper and his dog, carrying them all about a third of a mile down the mountain.
As it moved down slope, it was funneled into a steep creek drainage, and so it piled up quite a bit deeper down in the steep creek.
Carter surveyed the slide area around Rainbow Ridge from the air and on the ground in the days after the December 6th incident to better gauge the scale of the avalanche that slammed into the two backcountry skiers.
It did release quite high on the slope. They triggered it from lower down. They were maybe a third of the way up the slope or so, and the avalanche fracture line where it actually detached from the mountainside was way up near the ridge, almost 500, 600 feet above them.
Carter says this season's unusual weather has made the area's snowpack unstable and susceptible to avalanches. The first significant snowfall came in early December, and that formed into a crust, or as she calls it, a wind slab, on top of an unusually unstable base layer, all of which came crashing down on the skiers.
And that's ultimately what was triggered by Eric and Michael.
Carter says those dangerous conditions still exist in the eastern Alaska range.
It takes time for the snowpack to change, and this particular setup could last weeks or months.
And for that reason, she says it's unwise to attempt a body recovery mission right now. Carter is the Education Outreach Coordinator for the Alaska Avalanche Information Center and a forecaster with the Valdez Avalanche Center. She says she believes climate change is a major factor in the unusual weather of recent years and that it contributes to greater avalanche potential.
A lot warmer weather, more moisture, that does affect avalanches and creates larger avalanche events. And having a few of those within just a few years kind of gives us the heads up that maybe we might be dealing with this more and more.
That can make it hard for those who traverse the backcountry to predict and prepare for the conditions they'll encounter. Carter says that's compounded by a lack of real-time data for snow and weather conditions on the Alaska Range, compared to the extensive state and federal data collection sources for the area south of Anchorage around Alyeska Ski Resort.
There's not a forecast center that is responsible for the Alaska Range, so it is a data-sparse area.
Carter says, aside from the sometimes sporadic information from a few weather stations along the Alaska Range, outdoor recreationalists and others don't have a lot of data about conditions there. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaskans have heard a lot about the effects climate change has had on land in the state, but new studies suggest it's also having a big impact on the health of residents. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports for a series on climate change.
Climate change is occurring in Arctic regions much more quickly than other parts of the planet, and Alaskans are feeling the effects on their health. That's according to David Driscoll, director of the University of Alaska Anchorage Institute for Circumpolar Health Studies.
Well, we found that there were actually some significant health issues associated with environmental effects of climate change across the state.
The Institute's been conducting a study on climate change and health in two rounds, each with 90 participants who have lived in Alaska for at least 25 years. They filled out a monthly survey for 2 years, sharing observations about unusual weather and the health of members of their household and neighbors in communities in Northwest, Interior, and Southeast Alaska. Demographically, participants mirrored local populations, which are 80 to 90% Alaska Native. Driscoll says they heard the most comments about unintentional injuries due to thinner ice on rivers and lakes or unusual weather, such as rainfall in the middle of an Arctic winter that turned to ice.
People suffering slip and fall injuries, people going through the ice, people being caught out on trails when they're traveling to fish camp or to other locations outside the village.
He says unseasonably severe storms or cold created hazards.
There were also events of cold-related injuries, so frostbite and other sorts of issues, and unfortunately there were some mortalities.
Driscoll says warm, dry weather and the effects of the spruce root beetle, whose numbers were once kept down by the cold, have contributed to more asthma and other respiratory diseases.
In many cases, those were associated with exposure to smoke from wildfires, oftentimes associated with beetle-killed forest, and then also dust. So during periods of warming or drought, when there isn't a lot of rainfall or snowmelt, high wind events kick up a lot of dust, and it affects a lot of folks living in rural and remote communities.
In recent years on the Yukon River, unseasonably warm spring temperatures, rapid melting, and large ice flow movement have led to catastrophic floods in several communities. And the river is breaking up about a week earlier than it did historically. U.S. and Canadian agencies are tracking variables such as precipitation, snowpack, permafrost, and glacial runoff to determine what effects, if any, are due to climate change. Still, in the village of Alakanuk on the lower Yukon River, Jerry Davis of the Yukon Delta Fisheries Development Association says it's clear flooding and erosion there are getting worse.
It's beginning to affect the infrastructure of the village, not only structures, but also the very expensive water and sewer lines that were installed 20 years ago, you know, sufficient distance away from the river. But due to the erosion, which has accelerated, those lines are now threatened.
And Alakanuk City Administrator James Blow says the situation is urgent.
If we lose our water and sewer system, it's going to be a major blow to our village. You know, we'll lose teachers, we'll lose people out of the village. It would be devastating to our village.
Human waste can affect drinking water. And when they have to haul it by hand or pay for it by the truckload, people start to conserve water, and rates of respiratory disease and skin problems rise. Mike Brubaker is director of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, or ANTHC, Center for Climate Change and Health. He says the anxiety and fear triggered by poor conditions, such as the inability to hunt or travel due to thin ice or unstable sea ice, or living in a house that's sinking into the thawing permafrost, can also be damaging.
Mental health is huge, very important, and especially when people live in places where they're facing new kinds of threats, like coastal storms. Their home isn't as safe a location as it used to be. And people live for, you know, entire seasons with that kind of stress going on.
But Brubaker says people are also finding ways to stay healthy by adapting to the environmental effects of climate change. And ANTHC and UAA are working with communities to develop adaptation strategies. I'm Jocelyn Estes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes, Ann Hillman, and Jocelyn Estes in Anchorage, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, and Daisha Eaton in Bethel. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez and Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska. Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at Alaska.bp.com. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. From resource issues to recreational activities, APRN brings you the up-to-date information you need for life in Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.